Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon for Monday, the 5th of September, the 12th of September, the year 2011. Jeff Brown with you here for Juneau afternoon. Today we'll talk to Beverly Schoonover about Saturday's Coastal Cleanup Day. Writer and naturalist Jennifer Hahn will be here with a preview of her presentation at the library tonight on foraging for your food. We'll also be talking about Tim Olson about 360 North TV and Jeff Jesse from the Mental Health Trust Authority about a new series on mental health. We'll see the Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more today on a Juneau afternoon. The forecast for tonight, increasing clouds with a slight chance of rain later on. Forecast for Tuesday, it looks like rain is likely with high temperatures around 57 degrees.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Environmental and indigenous activists in Ecuador claim the government is using the terrorism label to repress dissent. Christina Onnestad has more.
Pepe Acacio is a Shuar leader and vice president of CONAID, the Confederation of Indigenous Nationalities in Ecuador. He says he's one of hundreds of activists charged with terrorism in his country.
There are about 187 to 200 cases against indigenous activists, campesinos, mestizos, and other leaders.
Acacio was arrested and charged with terrorism in 2009 for blockading the entrance to his community in the Amazon after the government tried to take control of their water, a resource the Shuar have collectively managed for centuries.
It's political because I'm a leader who fights for and defends our collective rights, nature, and our territory.
He faces up to 16 years in prison. But according to Ecuador's government, activists like Acacio have broken the law. Patricio Eduardo Barriga is spokesperson for the president's office.
No fue porque estaban defendiendo derechos.
It's not because they are defending rights. They are accused of terrorism because they violated our rights by closing access to the city, so the law has to resolve it.
So when somebody tries to close down a road, that's an act of terrorism.
It's the law. Ecuador is a country of laws.
Activists and their attorneys are using Ecuador's new constitution to defend their actions. The constitution, which was written in 2008, gives rights to nature and grants communities the rights to freedom of speech, rights to water, and rights to prior and informed consent. Terrorism charges against activists like Acacio aren't deterring their movements as the country grapples with what and how to develop their natural resources. Christina Onnestad, National Native News.
The first regional broadcast of a children's cartoon in the Lakota language is airing on public television stations in North and South Dakota. Charles Michael Ray reports.
12 native speakers from 5 different reservations took part in overdubbing 20 episodes of Berenstain Bears into Lakota. The nonprofit Lakota Language Consortium is one of the organizations behind the program. Will Maya is the executive director. He says one goal is to promote the Lakota language among young people.
Over 50% of the population of Lakota people is under the age of 18, and so it's a huge group of people who definitely want to learn the language and be exposed to as much of the language as they possibly can. Unfortunately, that's becoming harder and harder as the language sort of is out of use in most households. And this is a way to encourage kids to see the language as a positive, fun, modern thing that has relevance in today's world.
Archives of the Berenstain Bears in Lakota will be updated each week at www.lakotabears.com. For National Native News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
The Lummi Nation in Washington State is preparing to bless a healing totem headed for the East Coast. The totem will be part of a National Library of Medicine exhibit opening next month. A blessing and official launch ceremony of the 20-foot totem will be held Tuesday in Seattle. Carver's tribal and health officials will take part in the ceremony. The exhibit will examine Native concepts of health and illness and show how those concepts are tied to community, spirit, and land. During this week in 1989, the U.S. Postal Service issued a 28-cent stamp honoring Sitting Bull. The portrait of the Lakota leader was based on photographs from the Smithsonian Institution archives. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
If you are a Native American who experienced discrimination from the USDA while trying to get a farm loan, you could get a payment of up to $50,000 or more. There will be meetings in locations around the country between July and December 2011 where you can get free legal help filing a claim. More details and a full schedule of meetings is available at IndianFarmClass.com or 1-888-233-5506.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:06 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our first guest is Beverly Schoonover from the Juneau Watershed Partnership here to talk about Saturday's Coastal Cleanup Day. Beverly, thank you for coming down to the station today.
Thank you for having us.
So first of all, for people who don't know about the Watershed Partnership, could you educate us, please?
Sure. The Juneau Watershed Partnership has been around since 1998. We're Juneau's local watershed council. We're a nonprofit organization. We have a volunteer board of directors, a couple staff members, and we promote community stewardship and sustainable use of our local watersheds.
And what exactly is a watershed?
A watershed is an area of land where water drains into the ocean. So if you look around, pretty much all of Juneau is a watershed. Big watershed area back here is the Gold Creek Basin. We're draining right now into the Gold Creek watershed. What I like about watersheds is that they're everything. It's not just the streams. It's not just the fish. It's the bugs, the habitat, the birds, the humans, the people, the wildlife, everything that's the soil, everything that has to do with the watershed. It's really looking at the ecosystem as a whole.
And the organization started out as the Menindee River Watershed?
Menindee Watershed Partnership, yep, back in 1998, where we just worked out at the Menindee, and then we realized that, we needed to expand. So now we try to work from Taku River to Berners Bay.
And you do a variety of cleanup as far as coastal areas are concerned throughout the year, but this is the big one.
We have two big cleanup events a year, and this is our big fall event, which is International Coastal Cleanup Day. It's actually a global event that's sponsored by the Ocean Conservancy and NOAA, and volunteers all over the world are asked to clean up garbage off our beaches and oceans and then use data sheets to record exactly what type and what kind of garbage is found. And so all over the world, volunteers are going to be doing this on Saturday, and then we send in all of the data sheets to the Ocean Conservancy, and they count and add up totals, and then they produce a report every year that is basically the state of the ocean, the state of the beaches. And so, for example, last year, 498,000 volunteers volunteered, and they picked up over 7 million pounds of garbage. Last year here in Juneau, we had 141 volunteers, and they picked up 4,000 pounds of garbage from 17 beach areas in Juneau. And every year we try to bump that up. More volunteers, more areas to clean. Hopefully at some point we'll have less garbage that we pick up. But we're shooting still for over 4,000 pounds on Saturday. But we really need some help. Seems like there's so much going on Saturday, day of play, and lots of things going on. But even if folks just had an hour on Saturday to volunteer to pick up some garbage from our beaches, that would be very, very helpful.
What's the most common piece of trash you find here in Juneau, or is that the same worldwide?
We pretty much, here and worldwide, it's cigarette butts and plastic bits. For some reason, we just find, I love our volunteers when they count every plastic bit they find, which is really dedicated. But yeah, lots of little plastic, styrofoam, small things, which, eventually will break down and get right into the water and probably end up in the Pacific garbage flotation. What's that, the gyri? I can't remember what it's called. But, yeah, out in the Pacific Ocean. And so what our goal is get it off the beaches now, get it to the dump where it's supposed to be so it won't end up in the water.
What areas are you concentrating on?
We have anywhere there's a public access area in Juneau and there's a beach, we have volunteers going to them. Right now we have 10 spots still open. Echo Cove, we need volunteers for Eagle Beach. We need volunteers for Indian Cove, DuPont, Sheep Creek. We got this wonderful area right outside your studios right there, which is a very challenging area to clean up, so we need a big crew for that. We need a group out of Fish Creek and on Douglas. And what we ask is that since it's actually a citizen monitoring event where we try to get information from people, we ask that people pre-register. And we're trying to get groups. We're trying to get churches, youth groups, sports teams, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, anybody to come out and pre-register to clean up these areas. And then on the day of the event, we ask folks to show up just at Sandy Beach and OCREC if they just want to volunteer the day of event for individuals. And we'll have volunteers there from probably like 8:30 to 11, handing out bags and data cards and gloves for people to go pick up garbage.
And if they want to pre-register, how can they do so?
Call me, please, 586-6853. Email me at jwp@alaska.net. And like I said, some of these areas are going to need more than one person to clean up. I know there's some stuff out at Echo, definitely out here at the subport. We need a bigger group. But if people can call and pre-register at 586-6853, that would be great. Or just show up the day of the event at Sandy Beach or OCREC Recreation.
Do they need to bring their own trash bags or gloves?
We got trash bags, we got gloves, we got data cards. We might have coffee and donuts. First come, first serve. But bring your own boots and rain gear, because unfortunately it's not going to be like this Saturday, I bet. This weekend it's probably going to be rainy.
Beverly Schoonover, thank you for coming down and talking about the Junosian Watershed Partnerships with Coastal Cleanup Day, which is this Saturday going on from 9 o'clock in the morning till 11. Anything you want to add I might have forgotten to ask?
I'm hoping to see we have a regular group of volunteers who come every year, and we look forward to seeing you there.
What is a watershed? Hey, do you know? It's where water flows through rains or snows. It's the land beneath the feet where the water comes and goes. A watershed is here and near all around. Starts on higher ground, then it runs on down. It's upstream, downstream, wherever our neighbors are found. Headwaters are where it all begins. Starts as a trickle, then grows real big. From tributary streams, rivers and lakes, ends up in a mouth. That's what the naturalists say. Well, what is a watershed? Hey, do you know? It's where water flows through rains or snows. It's the land beneath the feet where the water comes and goes. Some watersheds are huge, sometimes they're small. Some begin in the mountains and drain near a mall. Some pass through a field, through a ditch, along a road. Even empty in a storm drain, where lots of water goes. Well, what is a watershed? Hey, do you know? It's where water flows up to the rains or snows. It's the land beneath our feet where the water comes and goes. Now keep the watershed healthy where you are. You'll provide a robust habitat near and far. Don't be foolish, never be rude, and dump out chemicals or petroleum crude. After a hard, hard rain and the waters flow and carries pollutants down to your neighbor's home. And then you ride. What is a watershed? Hey, do you know? It's where water flows through the rains or snows. It's the land beneath the feet where the water comes and goes. Farmlands, wetlands, cities and towns are places through which water runs down. Watersheds are homes for life of all kinds. Let's take responsibility and keep it all in line. Well, what is a watershed? Hey, do you know? It's where water water flows up to the rains or snows. It's the land beneath the feet where the water comes and goes. Our watershed is here and there all around. It starts on higher ground and it runs on down. It's upstream, downstream, wherever our neighbors are found.
The 22nd annual barn dance season opens this Saturday, September 17th at St. Anne's Parish Hall downtown on 5th and Gold. Tom Paul will kick off the big night at 7:30, teaching and calling contra dances to live old-time and bluegrass music by Jerry Fiscus and friends. As always, you don't need any experience or a partner. Just be ready for a good time and friendly atmosphere. Discounts for students and seniors and free for Saga and JVs. Big barn dance this Saturday. For more information, call 463-3214.
Here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, it's the 12th of September, 2011. The birthday of Henry Louis Mencken, H.L. Mencken, Baltimore, 1880. A satirist, critic, made fun of pretension, provincialism, and prudery, and was no friend of organized religion. It was Mencken who said, "The definition of Puritanism is the haunting fear that someone somewhere may be happy." He wrote, "The basic fact about human existence is not that it is a tragedy, but that it is a bore. It is not so much a war as an endless standing in line." He tried to catalog the American language in his book, The American Language, which he continued to update throughout his life. Mencken, who wrote, "To the man with an ear for verbal delicacies, the man who searches painfully for the perfect word and puts the way of saying a thing above the thing said, there is in writing the constant joy of sudden discovery, of happy accident." It's the birthday of the publisher Alfred A. Knopf, New York City, 1892. He was 23 when he started his own publishing house. He published Khalil Gibran's The Prophet, and it was a huge bestseller. Also the publisher of Kafka, Freud, D.H. Lawrence, James Baldwin, Theodore Dreiser, and his own favorite author, Willa Cather. It's the birthday of Michael Ondaatje, the poet, novelist, born in Columbia, Ceylon, in 1943, moved to England when he was 11, Toronto when he was 19. His novel, The English Patient, won the Booker Prize in 1992. It was on this day, 2008, the novelist David Foster Wallace committed suicide. He was 46, had suffered from depression since his early 20s, tried medications, nothing worked very well. Earlier this year, his unfinished novel, The Pale King, was published, set in an IRS office in Peoria, and its central theme is boredom. On this day, 1940, four teenage boys and their dog stumbled upon Paleolithic drawings in a cave in Lascaux, France, about 66 feet wide, 16 feet high, with around 2,000 drawings, mostly of animals, lots of horses and stags, some human figures. The drawings thought to be around 17,000 years old. They were in very good condition when the cave was first discovered, but then the cave was opened to the public, and 100,000 people traipsed through every year, exhaling carbon dioxide. As a result, the colors began to fade, and crystals formed, and algae, and mold, and bacteria. It was finally closed to the public in 1963. Here's a poem for today by Jane Hirschfield. "I ran out naked in the sun. I ran out naked in the sun, and who could blame me? Who could blame? The day was warm. I ran out naked in the rain, and who could blame me? Who could blame the storm? I leaned toward 60 that day, almost done. It thundered then.
I wanted more, I shouted, more. And who could blame me? Who could blame, had been before, could blame me that I wanted more? Upon by Jane Hirschfield, I ran out naked in the sun from her collection Come Thief, published by Alfred A. Knopf and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lending Tree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733. And by Constant Contact, combining the power of email marketing and social media for more customers and more time back on your clock. ConstantContact.com. Produced by Kathy Roach, written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
time is 3:26, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guest is Jennifer Hahn. She's a writer, naturalist, adventurous cook. She's kayak solo from Ketchikan to Bellingham. She's making a presentation at the Douglas Library tonight on her brand new book, Pacific Feast, A Cook's Guide to West Coast Foraging and Cuisine. Jennifer, thank you very much for being in the station with me today.
I am delighted to be here.
So first of all, basic philosophy of the book, please. And I should say, number one, it's a great book.
Oh, you're very kind. The basic philosophy of the book is to teach conservation through the palate. When I kayaked solo through the Inside Passage, I ate a lot of wild foods to keep my kayak light, and in the process fell in love with a lot of things, from giant red sea urchin to nori seaweed and different kinds of beach greens. And I was asked to write the book, but I had an ethical crisis to just give a free hand in information about all these things without building in sustainable foraging. So this is a book for foragers who wish to see these things that we love to eat and many of us don't even know about that well for the next 10,000 years that they're here. And I felt my one-pot dishes weren't exactly the best thing to put into the book, so I went to the best chefs I could find, and there are more than I would have loved to include. And so I have 65 chefs from Alaska to California in the Northwest Coast Cultural Zone area where all these wild foods exist. So preservation through the palate, a lot of quirky natural cultural history built in, and stories of my own, 20 essays woven through all the recipes.
Define foraging, if you can, as it relates to the book.
Foraging, as it relates to the book, I think of as I'm paddling along, hiking along, or even, say, driving to a beach with my shovel to get clams. Foraging is going a-looking for wild foods and nibbling here and there, and sometimes bringing enough home to put food by, like massive jars of kelp chutney, or perhaps you're going to bring home, as I did just yesterday, a lot of Turkish towel seaweed, which is full of carrageenan, which is a thickener for chocolate ocean pudding, which is almost rivals truffle ganache by the time you finish the recipe.
Is foraging for the faint at heart?
Foraging for sea urchin is for the possibly not for the faint of heart. And maybe even nori seaweed could be a little slippery. You know, people have mucosal issues, I think, here in America. But once you learn how to use seaweeds in a way that makes them just another vegetable, suddenly foraging is no longer for the faint of heart, and I win people over all the time with my cream of kelp chowder.
The book starts out with a list of recipes, tantalizing names like sea urchin bisque, razor clam risotto, horn tootin, bull kelp pickles. That sounds like a lot of fun. Did you develop a lot of the recipes yourself? I noticed you did have a few in the book.
Yes. Over the years, I've worked as a kayak guide for my own expedition company, and these were the tried and true recipes that even the squeamiest person would ask for seconds. And so I brought you a little sample here of chocolate ocean pudding. Would you like to try it?
I guess so.
Okay, so here's the seaweed. It's kind of like a nubby, dark burgundy towel, and this is Turkish washcloth. There's another Turkish towel, but they're loaded with carrageenan, and I simmered this seaweed in half and half for 20 minutes, strained it, and added very good organic chocolate chips.
Okay, it's in a little solo Dixie cup there, and I'm going to do this without getting it on the board. It's kind of reminds me of a small thing of horseshoe syrup, only a little lighter in color.
This is a lovely thing to serve over wild raspberries or toasted hazelnuts.
Mm.
You're not kidding me? You really like it?
It tastes like a wild chocolate mousse.
It is like a wild chocolate mousse, and we're talking the kind without horns.
Mm.
Now, I really should have. Now, my favorite thing to do is to serve this up in a horse clam shell that's been lined with graham cracker crust, and then you put in the chocolate ocean pudding. You put a few toasted hazelnuts on it, you put a candle in the center, and you bring it to your favorite person's tent. I mean, you will win any romance if you bring someone chocolate ocean pudding in a white clam shell at night with a lit candle.
I feel like you should just do the rest of the talking and I'll do the rest of the eating. What debt do we owe the native culture?
Say that again?
What debt do we owe the Native culture?
Oh, my goodness. I would say we stand on the shoulders of 10,000 years of First Nation wisdom. And I was very cognizant and appreciative of a number of elders who have taught me over time how to forage for things in a way that is not just sustainable to the plant or to the animal, but also feels like it gives something back to me. I feel like foraging is almost a little bit of a mystical experience, especially if you're a very hungry person. You come to a beach, you put something into your stomach that you found there wild, and you feel sustained. And so I'm always full of gratitude to the First Nations for the gratitude they show every time they pick something.
Are you afraid at all that the dishes may become too popular and you might run out of ingredients?
I certainly was very concerned about sustainable foraging versus kind of the pillaging foraging that does happen. And there are plenty of examples where, for instance, the wild ramp onion, which is harvested on the East Coast, was removed from woodland forests, acres and acres of them, and piled into trucks and taken off to New York to be sold at some of the expensive markets. And the same has happened even in the Seattle area, where people have come into Bellingham, Washington, and harvested many, many lady fern fiddleheads. That's the small spiral coiled fern before it opens up into a long elliptical feathery leaf. But they clear cut them all through the forest, loaded them into giant plastic bags, and went down to Pike Place Market and sold them. So I always tell people, if you go to a restaurant that serves wild food, do ask if it was harvested in a way that is sustainable. It's almost like teaching people about wild salmon. 10 years ago, you'd go into a sushi bar and you'd say, "Is this wild salmon?" And people would look at you cross-eyed, like, "What are you talking about? It's salmon." But it might have been farmed salmon. And I think the same is true today. It's really part of the eater's role and responsibility to help educate the people that work at a restaurant that they really want to see these things around for a long time. And so they ask that they buy from foragers that pick sustainably.
And you have an acronym that you use.
I do. The acronym is stewardship. And the first part of stewardship is to save the native species. They found in studies in Nepal, where a lot of harvesting happens for herbs, for instance, that go into many of our herbal tinctures and herbal caps, that when people started farming the wild plants instead of going to the wild populations would oftentimes get cut down, the forest would end up being used for wood, and suddenly those plants would disappear. So that's the number one. And the last one of stewardship is to, I believe, something about gratitude. I'm just trying to remember how I wove the P into that, but it may say something like, please stop or pause. Pause and give a little thanks. Yes, that's it.
Now, I imagine proper identification is tantamount to a recipe's success and also the diner survival. Talk a little bit about the photos by Max Smith.
Max Smith is one of my favorite ethnobotanist friends, and Mac and I have done a lot of foraging workshops over the years. Mac is one of these guys, like many of the people up here, that with a hook and line and a little bit of olive oil and maybe a fry pan, he could go out to an island and live comfortably for a month. And so I immediately approached Mac and said, would you be willing to put this book together with me? And so Mac has brought his artistic eye to photograph all of the different species in the wild. It was very important. I wanted to show them in their wild state, on a beach, on a mountain, wherever it was that they loved to grow. So they were easier to identify. Now, it's not field guide so much. Were it a field guide, I would have put up-close pictures of each blossom, leaf, etc. So it's really a book that goes together with a field guide. In fact, I have a laminated six-fold field guide I was asked to put together with the book that I don't know if you got a copy of it. But
yeah, it's great. It's the Pacific Coast foraging guide right here.
Yes, that's it. And so the idea is that Pacific Feast is a way of finding pleasure reading about foraging and reading how to do it well and finding recipes that go over the top. Some are quite easy, some are medium for the average kitchen cook like myself, and some are high-scale, five-star chef, bit complex. You might make them once a year, but they're divine. Now, I do have one here, though, from Dolly Garza. It's a kelp chutney that I'd love you to try. And Dolly Garza is Tlingit Haida. She used to live in Alaska and worked for the Alaska Extension Program at University Alaska Fairbanks. And now she's on Haida Gwaii teaching.
Ask her husband, Krista, to see if that's spot for me, because I'd have to see if you could have time to read a little bit from the book, that page I've noted there, page 51. I'm going to try this kelp chutney.
What do you think of the chutney?
I'm trying to do it without getting it on my iPad.
You know, I was going to bring it with a little cream cheese. It's really best with a bit of rice and vegetables. But I also serve it up on cream cheese and crackers. I have some tonight to share along with chocolate ocean pudding.
Well, you should mention you could be talking at the Douglas Library at 7 o'clock.
Yeah, 7 to 8 o'clock. I'm not sure how I'm going to fit it all in 1 hour, but I'm going to try.
Well, while I'm tasting this, you want to just go ahead and read that first paragraph from your book, please?
I would love to. So this is from a chapter called Berries and Roses. In the 1980s, when Mac and I sea kayaked through Moresby Sound to Hot Spring Island on Haida Gwaii, he was awed by the park-like landscape, Pacific crabapples, salmonberry, thimbleberry, salal, and strawberry plants appeared manicured. The island was more like a pastoral farm than a wind-blown rock in the middle of some untamed bay. Caretaking shined everywhere. Turns out Mac had stumbled upon a wild garden. Now, that may sound contradictory, yet cultivating the wilderness was the Pacific Coast norm, not the exception. During pre-European contact, First Nations people enhanced their wildberry patches by pruning and weeding. They were hunters and gardeners, working the wild land using accepted farming techniques. Women fertilized apple orchards with offal from salmon and game. They weeded out competing plants, maintained paths, and snapped off foliage to invite more fruit. These ingenious gardeners even used natural irrigation systems. For instance, they dug up berry bushes from one spot and transplanted them to misty waterfall ledges. During droughts, the waterfall's green fringe never went dry. The Mediterranean-like microclimate of waterfalls provided delicious berries over an extended season.
Jennifer Hahn reading from her brand new book, Pacific Feast, A Cook's Guide to West Coast Foraging and Cuisine. She'll be doing a presentation at the Douglas Library tonight from 7 to 8 o'clock, or maybe a little stretch a little bit afterwards. What's your favorite recipe in the book?
Oh, my favorite recipe in the book. Actually, it's very simple, and I just had it the other night. Well, besides chocolate ocean pudding, I actually have a couple favorites. I really love the urchin roe that is served up on it would be called a boiled potato slice or potato coin. There's a little dollop of sour cream, a little bit of red onion, and then some raw urchin. But, you know, I also really love, there's some nice recipe that is from a chef up in Anchorage, and it is a Matanuska carrot puree. On top of that is a lamb chop that has some Moroccan spices and spruce tip syrup drizzled over the whole thing. That's a lovely dish, too.
Making all my listeners hungry.
I'm getting hungry myself.
What, do you have a website?
Yes, I do have a website, and it's pacificfeast.com.
And Jennifer Hahn, thank you very much for coming down to the station and sharing your bounty. Before we go, you brought several bags of seaweed with you. Is seaweed big in your items of list of items?
Yes, seaweed is big in my items of must, what would I say, learn to forage, because this is the garden of seaweeds here, the whole inside passage. But up here in Alaska, you got some of the cleanest seaweeds in the world. Ever since Fukushima power plant went, you know, kind of haywire in Japan and a lot of radiation was absorbed by the seaweeds there, I would not be so excited about sushi that comes from Japan, nor would I buy sushi from China because it's known for being very polluted. But here, in the Northwest Coast, right here, Icy Strait, all through Lynn Canal. You have some gorgeous seaweeds. One of them here is wakame, or wing kelp, and this species is like the asparagus of the sea. This is what you have in every packet of miso soup you get with seaweed bits in it. And you could take it to the savory level, put it in a, say, casserole or soup, or you could take it to the sweet level and add sugar and brandy and cut it into strips and add it into things like figgy pudding. Now, nori seaweed, this is one of the most valuable seaweeds to First Nation people, and it's very red and stretchy, like a spent water balloon, a popped water balloon. But when you cook it in the oven, it turns a beautiful dark, and I should say toasted in the oven, it turns a beautiful dark blackish purple. And if you add a little olive oil, you cannot stop eating this. It's like the most nutritious potato chip imaginable, and it's 28% protein. Now, I have another seaweed here. You've all seen this. It's called popweed, bladder rack, rockweed, old man's firecrackers, and I would pop it here, but I'm afraid I'd cover the microphone with the goo inside. But it's a rabbit-eared float filled with a mucus that's like aloe, and that is super good for you for anti-inflammatory uses. You could smear it on your arthritis. You could stuff your extra tufts with it with hot water and walk around. I have a friend that does that all the time for arthritic feet. But it also is wonderful taken and put on a large cookie sheet, cooked at 200 degrees until it puffs up like a Cheeto inside. It gets all styrofoamy-like. And suddenly, it's this bulbous Cheeto that you take powdered cheddar cheese, toss it over the top, and you have a sea Cheeto. And last of all, I have sea lettuce. Sea lettuce is a green seaweed, and it is equivalent to the finest herbal table salt you can imagine when you dry it and crumple it over omelets or quiches.
You can meet Jennifer and all our seaweeds tonight at 7 o'clock at the Douglas Library. Jennifer, thank you very much for coming down to the station. Your book is called Pacific Feasts, a Cook's Guide to Foraging, West Coast Foraging and Cuisine. Thank you so much for coming down to the station today.
Oh, Jeff, my pleasure. Glad you enjoyed the chocolate ocean pudding.
Love the supper sea so much that sometimes we jump up in-
time is 3:46 in New York. Tune to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guests are Tim Olson from 360 North TV and also Jeff Jesse, who is the CEO of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here to talk about a new series on mental health that's airing on 360 North this week. Tim, thank you very much for being on the station today, and Jeff, thank you for being with us by the telephone.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Hi, Jeff. It's Jeff and Jeff. I'm the only person that's not named Jeff, so I hope this isn't confusing, but you know, on 360 North, we really try to provide public service, and we had this idea last spring that we wanted to provide some programming about mental health issues in Alaska. And there's a lot of programming out there, but we needed a little help, and we went to the Mental Health Trust and said we want to put together this series, and they provided some funding to help us acquire documentaries. They helped us select films that would be good films to show in Alaska and have topics and issues that would be of interest to an Alaska audience, because we wanted to tailor this to Alaskans. And the trust helped us review all of the different possible selections and pick those very best films. And in the end, they helped us put together a great list of referrals and resources and services, so we could provide additional information that was Alaska-specific to each film. And so Jeff Jesse and the team at the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority have really come through and helped us put this project together.
Jeff, could you give us an overview of the Mental Health Trust Authority, please?
Well, the Mental Health Trust Authority is a state corporation that acts like a private foundation. There was originally a million-acre land trust. The state mismanaged it. We were able to, through litigation, reform the trust. We now have 1 million acres of land and a $400 million cash endowment and a board of trustees that can take the income from those assets and use it to enhance the mental health system of the state of Alaska. It's a very unique enterprise.
Tell me about the TV programs and who are they directed at?
Well, they're directed at not only individuals who actually have mental health issues, but also their families, whether it's a film by a woman whose brother had Down syndrome, who talks about what she learned from her brother John, which was so much more important than she might have thought, to stories around people who have struggled with schizophrenia, depression, addictions, Alzheimer's disease, again, a whole range of different issues that many people in Alaska are struggling with, are looking for information for. For example, I'm sure many of your listeners are aware that autism is a growing problem, and parents are often really struggling to understand the disability and to access resources. And we hope through these films not only to be able to give people information in general about those subjects, but again, as Jeff mentioned, specifically direct them to Alaska resources that they can use.
Tim, tell me more about the series, if you could, please.
Well, we will be running for 11 weeks. We selected the best 11 films of several dozen films that I pulled together from different resources. We worked with the Mental Health Trust. They had a team that they put together of their beneficiaries and the people that they work with that know all of the different mental health topics and work with them on a daily basis in Alaska, and helped us select the best cross-section of films that reflected issues and illnesses and things that the people that work in this field every day thought were most important for us to deliver. So every Tuesday night, starting tomorrow at 9 p.m., we will air a different documentary. They are all introduced by Jeff Jesse. That's one of the reasons he joined us today. And Jeff and the team at the Trust, working with the social service agencies and all the people that they work with throughout the state, put together immediate resource and referral information. So if people watch one of these programs over the next 11 Tuesday nights and see something they want more information about, see something that they recognize that might be helpful to themselves or a family member or friend, they will have immediate information available to them at the end of each program that's specific to that particular issue.
I want to get back to the Mental Health Trust Authority. Jeff, What are some misconceptions people have about the trust?
Well, I think one misconception is that somehow we're able to fund the core operating costs of the mental health program. If you look at all the services that different parts of the mental health program provide, from services for people with developmental disabilities, people with Alzheimer's disease and related dementias, substance abuse, alcohol addiction, mental health services, if you include Medicaid, it's about a $400 million expenditure for the state of Alaska. The Mental Health Trust only generates about $25 million a year. So obviously we are not going to fund a substantial, even minority, of those total expenditures. What we can do is operate as the venture capital for the state's mental health program, a very unique role, in looking at how to improve services over time and get more bang for the buck, if you will, out of those state expenditures. So we have worked on developing and replicating mental health courts. We've looked at creating more housing options for beneficiaries. We're looking at working on how to improve workforce development. All these are things that it's almost impossible to get the legislature to fund, but are critical to improving the effectiveness and efficiency of the state's mental health program.
Must be gratifying to work for an organization that does so many good things for so many people.
Well, it really is. It's a privilege to work here. You know, one of the things I really appreciate about our trustees is they are very focused on outcomes. Everything we do is evaluated rigorously. For example, even in the area that these films are showing in, we regularly ask people in the public what their awareness is of these different disabilities, what their confidence is that treatment is effective for some of these conditions, and generally try to improve people's confidence that people that have these disabilities can become very productive and useful members of the society. So we even measure those changes in public perception, as well, of course, specific outcomes around treatment. Are people, are their symptoms getting better? Do they have housing? Do they have a job? All those sorts of things.
Tim, where did you find the films?
Well, we searched high and low. We tried to pick films about these various topics that were generally done in the Pacific Northwest or had specific interest to an Alaska audience. And I just want to point out that the first film that's tomorrow night is about teen romance. It's The Mental Health Risks of Relationships. The teens tell the story, but there are also experts and other people helping lead us through the story. It's a little bit different than the rest of the films. The following week, there's a program on Alzheimer's disease. The week after, a program on addictions. There's just a wide range of topics that these cover. So tomorrow night at 9, folks can tune in and start watching these really interesting programs that we could not have put together this series without the help of the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
Is there some clearinghouse for all the information that you're going to be sharing?
The trust has all of this information on their web. We're providing the information. We're also there's the Alaska 211. They have this really well put together. So this will lead people immediately to web and phone resources where they can get links to everything that they need.
And that series starts this week?
Tomorrow night at 9 o'clock. They repeat on Sunday evening as well. So there's an opportunity for everyone to get a chance to watch.
I've been talking with Tim Olson and Jeff Jesse. Jeff Jesse is the CEO of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Would you like to add anything that I might have forgotten to ask?
No, one thing I would like to add, though, is KTOO has been a tremendous partner. We've done several projects with them over the last few years, and they brought this to us, and we saw the value of it right away. And having organizations like KTOO really working hard to come up with these public service types of programming is just really a tremendous advantage to everyone in the state, I think.
All right, Jeff, Jesse, thank you very much for being on the show. And Tim Wilson, thank you for being on the show as well.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. Once nesting season ends, these violet-green swallows seem to know it's time to party. They usually nest as single pairs in cavities or nesting boxes in the western United States. But now, they gather on electrical wires by the dozens and chatter away as part of their pre-migration socializing. They're not alone. Tree swallows, both adults and juveniles, often join the violet-greens before they all begin their southbound migration to Mexico and Central America. Cliff swallows may gather in the same fashion. And barn swallows, not just in North America, but across Europe and into China, party too. But all this jovial conversation isn't just a celebration. Birds flock for protection. The more eyes watching, the greater the chance of noticing predators. Also, birds flock to share information about where to find food. Migrating by day, swallows forage for insects as they move south. Next spring, when they return, you won't see the swallows sitting on telephone wires. Then it's all business as they begin selecting their sites and building their nests. They save their socializing for the fall. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
And you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. The Valley and Ock Bay area tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT Sirsuna at 91.9. And Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. And in Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. We're also live online at www.ktoo.org. Tomorrow at 3 on a Juneau afternoon, Pat Moore will be your guest host. His guest will be Peter Metcalf with news about next year's Southeast Alaska Sports and Recreation Show. Becca Parks will be here to highlight Wednesday's kickoff party for this season's LEGO League. Sarah DeLeo and Jessica Dempsey will be here with details about Saga's 25th anniversary celebrations. And we'll also learn about the school district's AVID program with guest Lori Scandling. At Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music and more tomorrow at 3 on a Juneau afternoon. With the forecast for tonight, increasing clouds with a slight chance of light rain later on, low temperatures around 50 degrees. Forecast for Tuesday, rain likely with high temperatures around 57 degrees. We have next, it's All Things Considered. Thank you for tuning in to a Juneau afternoon today and have a great evening.